You choose your friends. You choose them well. And then you are loyal to them and stick with them. If you've chosen badly, then you've made a mistake and you pay for your mistakes. But that story that I learned at age 12 or so has stayed with me my whole life, that you just choose rightly and well, have some confidence in your choices that you're making, and then be loyal to the people you've chosen.
Welcome to the Problematic Podcast, a show that gives you the chance to be the hero in helping solve some of the world's largest problems. Find out which teams need your skills today at problematic.app. And now, here's your host, Sean Tierney.
All right, hey everybody, welcome to the Problematic Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Tierney, and I am here today in a special interview with my father, David Tierney. David is, I don't know where to start on this dossier. We did a podcast 4 years ago on your and mom's 50th wedding anniversary when we were in Martha's Vineyard. I'll just read some of the accolades here. Named best lawyer in America every year since 2003. Two-time best lawyers, lawyer of the year in construction law, civil construction litigation. Wrote the book on construction litigation. Recipient of the Han Kachina Award for public service. Valley Leadership Man of the Year Award and Justice Learned Hand Award, amongst others. And I don't know where to, I mean, we could probably read your CV.
That's plenty.
I figured, though, like, let me set the context for the people listening. So I typically do two types of interviews. I do a problem interview, which is where I find a domain expert in a problem, and we try to deconstruct it with the goal that maybe someone listening, if we tear apart the problem and we drill into the mechanics of how it works and who it affects and what the pieces are, that maybe someone listening can get an idea of what we might be able to build to attack that problem. That's one type of interview. The other type I do is a skill interview where I have people on that, you know, that have some type of skill. Maybe it's user interface design or, you know, lean startup or one of these skills that could be very relevant to what we're doing. And I think in your case, we can mesh the two. So we'll do kind of a hybrid interview here with you. But why don't we start, for the people that haven't heard that other interview that we did 4 years ago, why don't you just tell a little bit, you know, 1 minute on your background, maybe.
So I went to a very rural high school. From there, I went to Brandeis University, entering in 1958. In 1962, I went on to Harvard Law School. After 3 years of law school, I did a clerkship with the Supreme Court of Massachusetts, at which point I had to go either in the Army or I had to go somewhere else because the Vietnam War was raging. So I chose to go in the Peace Corps at the last moment, and I ended up in Venezuela. And I was assistant to the first city manager ever in Barquisimeto, Venezuela, the first city manager in any part of Venezuela. I did that for almost 3 years, ended up at the very last part being a staff person for 6 months or so when the Peace Corps needed to fill a hole they had. Came back to Phoenix, Arizona, joined a law firm, and the law firm turned out to be just a real barn burner. It just took off, and now my name's on the door since about 1974. We have 42 lawyers. I do construction litigation. But lately, for the last 6 or 7 years, I've been a mediator and an arbitrator in construction disputes.
Great. And just for the people listening, if you hear noise in the background, we found the most quiet place we can. We're here in Porto, Portugal. My parents are both visiting, and we're just in the corner of a hotel here. And if you hear some background noise, that's what it is.
It's actually a bar.
Doesn't get any quieter. My room's too small, so we can do it here. Yeah, so that's great. So on the theme of service, you and mom met in the Peace Corps. Most of the people listening are folks who are, you know, socially conscious, who are tuning into this to figure out how they can help, how they can apply their skills and talents towards a good cause. Is there anything you've learned in your 50 plus year career of litigation experience for systematically dissecting a problem? Is there a skill that you can transfer there? Anything you can help, you know, how do you do that?
You've seen an article with my picture on it a long time ago, and somebody wrote a headline when they wrote this article, and they said, "What are we litigating here?" So I constantly see young lawyers that are all thrashing about with all the nuances and the details and all kinds of things that come up in lawsuits, and they've lost sight of what it is that we're really there litigating. And it seems to me that the part that a lawyer plays in all of these problems is to be more concise, to boil the problem down to its essentials, pick out what can be affected and changed or presented well and convince a judge of X or Y or Z. And I see so many lawyers that are just lost in the thickets. They're trained in their law school education to not miss a point. And they go on making sure they do not miss a point.
So losing the forest for the tree, getting fixated on one little aspect of it. Do you have any, is there a science or how do you do that reliably? Because it seems like one of those things that's, is it an instinct or is it something that can be taught?
Well, since I do litigation, it seems that every problem is like an onion. You keep peeling back pieces and you keep discovering new stuff that's part of the problem. And so the trick is to keep in your mind that you want to make everything concise and to be looking for the key points or the thread that you need to focus on. But you got to keep this in the frontal lobe as you're going through 10,000 documents or, you know, 50,000 exhibits or whatever. I had an arbitration a couple of years back. It lasted 5 weeks, 70 witnesses, 10,000 documents. And it's easy to lose the forest. You cannot find the one point or the 6 points that are going to make up the resolution of this matter for the blizzard of facts that flow before you. Ugh.
Yeah. Well, in a litigation, you do trials in front of a jury or in front of a judge, typically?
Well, I've done probably 50 trials in front of juries, but ordinarily it would be either an arbitrator or a judge that I would be appearing before. The jury trial is disappearing in America. It's just so expensive, time-consuming, and the chances of it going off the rails in one side or the other side. Lawyers don't like to do jury trials if they can possibly avoid them. They'd rather be in front of a judge who will understand the issues mostly, and better yet, an arbitrator who is well-versed in that particular field of practice. I always recommend to my clients, if we can possibly get there, to go to an arbitration, because ordinarily the arbitrator is subject trained. I do construction. I swear I go to court and I'm in front of a judge and I have to say, "Judge, this end of the shovel goes in the ground," because he doesn't know anything about construction law. He's versed in probate. He's versed in car crashes. He's versed in antitrust, but he's never had much experience or any experience in construction.
Yeah, I think what I'm getting at is most of the projects that we tend to undertake are a matter, they come down to a matter of persuasion. So it'll be an app or a marketing campaign or some type of awareness outreach. And it involves persuading a group of people over to a certain opinion. And that seems more to me less like the arbitrator, where they're the subject matter expert and you can rely on a baseline level of competence. And instead, more you kind of have to build everything for the lowest common denominator.
You're absolutely right. My life is always focused on one man or one woman serving as a judge or an arbitrator whom I have to convince. And in the case of an arbitrator, when you're done with your presentation and when the case is over in front of the arbitrator, there is no appeal from what the arbitrator does. It's extremely limited circumstances. So everything hinges on making your case to that one person for those 3 or 30 days that you're in front of them. And I don't very often find myself anymore in front of a jury where I have 12 or maybe 8 that I have to convince. But in times of yore, when I would be in front of a jury, the system in Arizona and almost every place in the United States is such that a lawyer gets presented with a panel of 30 people. The court asks questions to the 30. It gets winnowed down. And finally, we have a pool to choose from. And then there's a crucial moment where the lawyer has to select and choose.
Voir dire.
Which, yes, right? It's after voir dire. you have to choose which of these jurors' nominees that you're going to take. And it is a great art to figure out who it is on that jury will be understanding, likely to be inclined somewhat towards the presentation that you're going to make. It's really the art of the trial lawyer. I don't often work in the circumstance that you're talking about. I used to do cases in front of city council, which would be, in case of Phoenix, 9 persons, and we would get up and have only 5 minutes, you know, to speak to city council because they control the agenda so tightly and everything is done with documents the night before, and then you get up and you have just a few moments to speak very concisely to 9 people, some of which don't understand what you're talking about or have no sympathy to what you are presenting. And so those were bad nights. Those were tough evenings in front of city council in Phoenix, Arizona.
Yeah, and that's far more like what our situation is, in that we don't have the luxury of picking the jurors or the audience for it. You get kind of you have who you have, and it's your job now to convince those people, bring them over to your point of view. From your experience, is there a strategy that is timeless in that? Like, do you approach each one of those in the same way, where you know, is it like a linear 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 recipe that you can go through, or is every, like, how do you approach a trial? How do you decide on the strategy?
Well, of course, it depends on the subject matter. And there are really 2, 3 basic ways to approach presenting a matter to, let's say, an arbitrator. That's the easiest way for me to conceive of this. One thing that's always helpful is to do it chronologically, because the arbitrator knows where you are and where you're trying to get to in terms of time. And he can see the progression along the timeline. I mean, if I'm going to make a presentation in a construction case, the first exhibit I put up is a timeline showing the history of this particular project. And then I explain, each witness puts his finger, in effect, on this timeline and says, I am talking about when the steel was being produced and cut and delivered. And this is the portion of the timeline. It makes so easy. It's like a Christmas tree. You are hanging an ornament at different branches of the Christmas tree, but this is a linear, and it's important that it's linear because it makes it so easy to understand the importance, the way it relates back or forward or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the other is, if it's a fraud case, now you need to show the overarching intent and the scheme and so forth. And that may not be linear. That may be to take a particular witness and show that he or she has been lying or misrepresenting, and then going back and sticking onto that one bubble what's relevant about how it came to be that fraud succeeded. And so I think those are the 2 basic ways that most lawyers would attack presenting a legal question. I don't think there's anything else that I could imagine that I would use in architecting how I present. Maybe that's because it's the way other lawyers have always done it. That's why the arbitrators expect it, their lawyers themselves. And so, yeah, the chronological for me is the most usual and most convenient.
For is in terms of a way of presenting the facts that you already have, but I think a step before that, like arguably famous for just spending an insane amount of time preparing and reading everything and ingesting all this information. It sounds like that. I mean, to me, when I think of what you do, that seems like the key step.
You know, I think back 20, 30 years, there were no computers assisting us in managing documents. So in 1987, I had a case. I was opposed to the Navajo Nation. And I had a client that was accused of having defrauded the Navajo Nation on a real estate deal. We had 10,000 meaningful documents, and we had them in a hall, must have been 150 feet, 200 feet long, in boxes. And so I got an associate in the law firm, and she read, Gay Gould was her name, she read everything in the boxes, and she made a map of what was in each box. And then I would ask her questions to follow themes, to investigate what she had seen, what had passed through.
ChatGPT.
Yes, she was. Before ChatGPT. You know, and this is, it's interesting, the evolution of using computers. Then we went to, you know, folks having a schema, a program, and they would look at a document and they would manually fill in 7 coded items about each document, from to exhibits, subject matter, date, you know, all that kind of stuff. And but it was done by a paralegal, just one by one by one. And then we've had some, you know, interim steps, but now we're at ChatGPT, where you can take 5,000 documents, scan them, and then ask questions about the documents. I mean, it was what I used to do with Gay Gould 30 years ago, after she had spent 3 months of going down that 150-foot hall and reading every single paper and making a note as to what was where. Gee, what an evolution in terms of the way we practice law in the United States.
I had a contract that I had to read. It was a 150-page legal contract for investment. And I used a thing called pdf.ai, uploaded the document, and then could talk to it as if I was talking to a lawyer who had read the document. I could ask questions, what happens in this scenario if you default? What happens in that scenario? And it answered back with, as if it was a lawyer who'd read the document.
And the only caution I have, of course, to these days is you got to make sure checking some or all of these to see if it's hallucinations and it's giving you a bunch of bullshit when it can't think of the answer. It just makes it up. I mean, we've had some legendary occurrences. A couple of lawyers in New York really got themselves in some hot water because they filed briefs that had a dozen or more
citations for cases didn't exist, right?
They absolutely were made up out of thin air with numbers of, you know, such and such a volume of the book, such and such a page, or from 512 to 518, and made these points, and Judge so-and-so wrote the opinion. It was all bullshit. There was no such thing, and I've seen half a dozen demonstrations since indicating you got to watch out. That's why I like the idea of ChatGPT on the very controlled universe of documents, which is the 5,000 pages or the 50,000 pages. There's nowhere to run to. You know, you're stuck in a universe. It's not like when ChatGPT took everything before September 21 and took, you know, counter opinions and phony opinions. And, you know, if I deal with ChatGPT and it's about 5,000 or 50,000 documents, I know it's going to be circumscribed as to where it can go or what it can say or what it can make out of any question I give to it.
Yep. Speaking of the technology and the legal stuff, you know, as you know, Tim Piganelli, the guy you introduced me to, I went to work for 2 years for this guy and dealt with things like summation and these programs, and ended up learning 3D animation and the value of, you know, if they say a picture is worth 1,000 words, then an animation is worth, I don't know how many words, but a lot more, being able to convince a jury of, you know, demonstrating some mechanism and how quickly you can convey information when it's shown in the form of an animation.
Tim is now working on the East Coast. I think it's Georgia or Alabama, somewhere there. And he had some huge case he was working on. But he told me that I had suggested to him that instead of being just forensic, working just on cases that were going before an arbitrator or a judge or a jury, Tim ought to branch out into something called a new form of letting out contracts in the field of construction. It used to be the highest bidder took the contract, the lowest bidder took the contract. You know, the owner would be sitting there and he'd look at the bids and he'd just choose the lowest bid and that was the end of the game. But 15 years ago, it began to appear in the United States that we had a new system where 3 or 4 or 5 contractors would meet quality criteria, and then there would be a process where each of them would thoroughly understand the job, and then there would be a negotiation with one or more to get the price. Well, pardon me, but the first step is, how do you get in the group of 5 that's chosen out of the 50 contractors that want the job? So I told Tim that I thought I saw coming a day where his skills would be vital to see who would be allowed from the universe to be among the few nominees chosen to make the serious bid on the job. And Tim has made a part of his life this business of presenting for a company that wants to get a $30 or $60 million bridge making or tunnel making or building job, present their company as the very best. And for that, animation, beautiful pictures. I mean, it is a selling process that did not exist in construction law 15 years ago. And Tim has been pretty much in the forefront of that. And he's good at it. Boy, he gets a lot of business as a result.
Well, it took us down rabbit holes. I remember the Stray Voltage case. We had to, there was this thing, I mean, things that you never know that even exist, but it was some rural area in the Midwest that had this issue where the power lines were overloaded and they were never built to handle the capacity where the little town grew to like 10 times the size. And so now all of a sudden the cows go to drink water and the lines aren't grounded. So the cows are getting zapped every time they try to drink water. And all the cows just stop drinking and they all die of dehydration. And this is a thing. And we had to somehow, convey how electricity works and how
explain it. Yeah.
Show the cows drinking and how this all happens.
And animation is the way to do it. If you can't tell a story, not only in oral terms, but also visually, if you can't do both and maybe more, then you're not going to win the jury's favor or the judge's favor when you make your presentation. And I can remember cases as far back as 40, 50 years ago where figuring out, I think that's another skill a lawyer has, how do you figure out how to express what similes, what adverbs, what adjectives will get through to the jury? What it is you're trying to express. I mean, you usually write your closing argument, then you figure out the string of witnesses you're going to put on, and then you do your opening at the last, because now you've selected all the exhibits you'll be putting on with your witnesses, and then you prepare for surprises, and now you're ready for trial.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned storytelling. On that subject of stories, I was hoping we could go through a couple. There's just a handful that have always stuck with me that we grew up with, but I was wondering if you could share the Dan Harkins one.
So my father, in the 20s and 30s, his best friend was a guy named Dan Harkins, and they both grew up in Upham's Corner in Boston, actually in Dorchester, and they were among 25 or 30 guys in kind of a pack that were in the neighborhood gang at the time. I don't mean it in a negative way, they just happened to be all friends. And they had a singing group that they had, and they had a football team and so forth, and Dan was my father's special buddy. Comes 1937 or so, and Dan gets a letter that asks him to come to the U.S. Post Office in Boston, Massachusetts, to a particular room. And it's a governmental official-looking letter. And he's not sure what it is, but he goes down there, and there's two guys in the room, one desk, an extra chair. He sits down, and they say, "We understand that you speak German. As a matter of fact, in your home growing up." And he says, "Yes." They said, "Well, we're the FBI, and we would like to have you go to Chicago, take a phony job there that we will provide, and spy on the German Bund, which was growing in Chicago." There was a lot of anti-war, pro-Nazi sentiment in the Chicago area. There was a guy named Father Coughlin on the radio who was preaching that the United States should help the Nazis and go against the Russians. And so Dan agrees to go, and he was pretty good with languages, but German was his very best. He goes to Chicago, and after two or three years of living there, the FBI asked him to pick up and go to Germany, where he would become friendly, and he had some kind of a business connection that made it seem possible and plausible for him to be in Germany. And he became an agent inside of Germany for the OSS, later called the CIA. And so all during World War II, Dan was inside Germany, rubbing elbows with Ribbentrop and Hitler and Goering and the rest of them. And his friends here in the United States just dumped on him. They felt that he was a traitor and he was just a dreadful person, and how could you do this? And my father, according to a friend of his that told me this, my father was the guy who said, "No, I know Dan. This is not right. I have nothing to say about it, but it's not Dan doing it. It's not this way." And so comes the Nuremberg trial at the end of the war, and it comes out that Dan is there to testify against all these luminaries that are still alive for the Nuremberg trial. And Justice Jackson is sitting up there, and there's the trial going on, and Dan appears, and he's a witness, and it comes out that he's a spy and so forth. I wouldn't know this except that one of my father's friends, when I was 11, 12, something like that, sat me down on some occasion and told me the story. And I guess the teaching that I take from it, and the reason I told you and your brother when you were kind of small, is you choose your friends. You choose them well. And then you are loyal to them and stick with them. If you've chosen badly, then you've made a mistake and you pay for your mistakes. But ordinarily, you know, appearances are often very deceiving. It's like the movie Chinatown. We don't really know what's going on beneath the surface in one set of circumstances and another. But that story that I learned at age 12 or so has stayed with me my whole life, that you just choose rightly and well, have some confidence in your choices that you're making, and then be loyal to the people you've chosen.
Yeah. Well, I think it's timely because we're entering into an era with the AI stuff and these deep fakes where you're going to start to, there's going to be fooling of a large population of people with, you know, media that's just completely artificial and made up. And it's going to require, I believe it's going to reach the point where unless you've signed digitally your video or whatever, then you can't trust that it came from you. But in absence of that, it is going to be things like this where you're just going to have to know that, you know, there's no way that person would have said that. Let's look a little deeper and not take it at face value.
So when I was in Brandeis, I had the good fortune to decide to go into child psychology as my major. And, you know, I thought at the time I might become a child psychologist. And then as time went on, I was in the civil rights struggle, and I realized that lawyers make things happen. Child psychology is really important in many respects in life. So now back to child psychology. I learned tells, you know, how you sit down with a person in a conversation and you look to see if their wrists are slack or if their wrists are tight and their fists are clenched and so forth, and eye control and so forth. I mean, the Israelis have been masters in this for a long, long period of time of putting a person in an interrogation room and looking for tells. And I think they've taken it to a height far beyond what I learned in child psychology. Child psychology used to serve me very well in that crucial decision as to who should be on the jury. But it also served me in many, many positions in my life when trying to decide whether to have confidence and trust in somebody or not. And I think you're right that the challenge of the next 20 and 40 years maybe is to be able to say, I can believe what this person says. Partly that's, does it square with my understanding of the universe, but also there are certain tells about when the person is speaking to you and choices of subject, manner in which it's expressed and all that sort of stuff. But I think it's going to be the crucial thing that people need to learn.
Judgment and discerning.
Absolutely, yes.
Well, on the child psychology front, another story that I was hoping to get out of you was the hot poker, the Abraham Maslow. You were in Maslow's class.
Unbelievably, Brandeis, being only 10 years old when I was there, it had started in 48 and I entered in 1958. The purpose of Brandeis was to serve as a catch-all for children of Jewish America who could not get into Harvard or Yale or Columbia or Princeton or any of the fine schools in America. Jews simply weren't being accepted. So when it began to come together, the president, Abram Sachar, from Illinois University, Sachar went around recruiting the most amazing faculty. and I took introductory psychology from Abraham Maslow, the man of
the hierarchy of needs.
The hierarchy of needs, but it was a year course, and he was a tremendous teacher. He was a tremendous teacher. And so one of his sessions, he had somebody come in who was a hypnotist. And I had my skeptic beliefs. I wasn't so sure the hypnotism was a real thing or that it was very serious and so forth. I was sitting next to my roommate, Steve, and they called for volunteers to go up, and Steve volunteered, and he went up on the stage. And asked, Maslow was sitting there in a comfortable chair, and the hypnotist was there, and Steve sat down, and they had a little conversation, put him to sleep. And I thought, Steve was a very tightly wired guy. He was an artsy guy, and he was very intense. When Steve was sitting on the stage, to my amazement, the expert, he's got a pencil in his hand. And he reaches over, and he says, Steve, I'm going to touch your arm, and this is a hot poker. And he touched Steve's arm. Steve drew his arm back in a sudden movement. And sure enough, a welt formed on Steve's arm. I mean, it was a visible red welt, like he'd been burned with this pencil. And I thought, Jesus, this is the autonomic nervous system producing a welt on your body by the psychosomatic suggestion that you were having a burn inflicted on your left bicep. And it taught me that much of disease is a result of something in your mind, something that you've imagined or thought or permitted in your mind. And all my life I've believed that at least one third or more of disease symptoms are mentally created. And your autonomic system will pay attention to whatever your mind is telling it is happening on your left bicep, as if you were on the stage and the ventriloquist and the guy touches your bicep.
The whole mind over matter, welt on the body because you thought it was a poker. I just don't even know how to explain that.
Well, I took a course at Brandeis, and it was called Emotions. And it was taught by Paul Klee, K-L-E-E, and he was a fugitive from Harvard. It was on the faculty. He was a famous guy. And we started the conversation. We went to the first class, and there were about 20 of us, and we're taking this course. We sit down, and Paul Klee comes in, big, tall, impressive guy with a huge beard, and he says, "Yogis sit in the river Ganges. They do not stoop to drink." And he closed the book with a snap, and he left in the first class. That was the end of the first class.
Meaning
and
reverse.
What it was saying was, we're back to the poker. Yeah. What those yogis do is they reverse the peristalsis, and they drink through their anus. They suck up water through their anus. They do not bend down and drink water. They simply sit there cross-legged, and they control their autonomic functions by their minds. And that was after Steve and the poker and so forth. But it was further. What Clay's point was so much of emotions is something we generate, and the effect of sadness, the effect of depression and so forth. It's really something that you can, to some extent, some considerable extent, you can control yourself if you have the willpower and the thought. And I've seen you do this in your life. You have controlled tremendously on occasion, overcoming sadness or depression.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there's a lot of examples of, smiling leads to happiness. You can generate happiness simply through forcing yourself to smile. There was a book I read recently called Breathe by James Nestor that talked about these Tibetan monks who could do this thing called Tummo breathing, I believe, where they will generate heat. They sit there and no fur coat, no anything. They can sit in the snow and just through breath generate enough heat to, survive. So there's plenty of examples of this. I just thought though the hot poker on the skin raising a welt is just indisputable evidence of some mind over matter stuff that we don't understand at this point.
You know, that's a common phrase, mind over matter.
Yeah.
It's mind over autonomic system. And it's not the matter. I mean, that would be making a glass on a table move by virtue of your mind. But your mind controlling how your body performs or experiences heat and cold. You can trick yourself into thinking that you're not that cold.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, I'd say like in this last chapter of the interview here, a lot of problems coming down the pipe. You've seen a lot. You've been through a lot. What do you see if you could solve, I don't know, if you wave a magic wand and fix three things, like what do you see the biggest challenges confronting society in the next 10 years?
Well, I think mental health is a challenge beyond any. Millions and millions of people, say in our country, the United States, millions and millions of our 310 million population have varying degrees of mental illness. It is the generation of our homelessness issue in large part. I mean, really 70, 80, 90% of them on the streets are people with serious mental health issues. We have almost no sympathy and no public resources directed towards mental health problems in America. And I think it is a real cancer on our society. And until we get serious resources directed towards mental health, I don't think we can solve a dozen of our problems. Prison problems, education problems, homelessness problems. And so one of the things I've done in my life is to involve myself in a part of the 501c3 charitable corporation Good Works issues in Phoenix, which would teach me about mental health. And so I haven't become a real student, but I've learned to kind of absorb what's going on so I can be pendiente and aware of what, if anything, our society, let alone our government, is attempting to do with mental health. I don't see it happening. The second issue is a physical problem. We have a serious water problem in the United States. The good water is in all the wrong places. We have lots and lots of cities, Jackson, Mississippi, parts of Detroit. The water purification is abysmal, and people are drinking water which is contaminated, not necessarily with organisms and bacteria, but instead with all the wrong kinds of metals, arsenic and heavy metals and so forth, and we are not getting at it. And this is affecting the health, maybe the mental health in part, of the population. We have large sections of our population, and we are not a third world country, but we are not paying sufficient attention to what goes on in the use of water in the United States. Maybe the next huge wicked problem, to use from your website the word wicked, is the fact that our oceans, we seem to think that they are a dumping ground, a system of transportation. We seem to think that they're anything but what they should be. The oceans are absolutely fouled with enormous amounts of plastic, and this is going to come back and bite us. We saw some events in Florida in the last couple of years, huge amounts of seaweed, dying seaweed, and plastic coming up on the shores. We see an extreme warming of the water, partly climatic, but partly also the fact that the water can't move and alter and flow the way it has in the past. And, you know, the world's got a radiator, and the radiator is the ocean. And to the extent that we do not let the radiator function the way it has for the last seven millennia, I think we're going to put the world in trouble. I know that sounds like an incredibly huge problem, but it is. All of these problems come back to the role of the mediator. I'm sorry, but you cannot solve any of these problems without having people who can serve as a mediator between competing monetary interest groups. I'm sorry, but there are certain manufacturers of products that don't want any changes in the water situation. There are certain people who, economic reasons, don't want the oceans to become any better cared for than they are right now. There are people who make money off selling drugs or whatever to the populace that don't really care, don't really want any changes in the mental health situation in the United States.
It's not even that they don't care. It's that they would seek to preserve the problem.
Their incentives are all in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
And it's not in my backyard. It's I don't want to deal with the problem. And the other guy is saying, let me tell you why my way is best, because I come out on top when people are in this condition and I can sell them whatever drug.
Okay, well, so there's a lot there. So just to recap, the homeless, mental health, prison lumped in because those are related. And by the way, for people listening, I think it was episode 4 or 5, I interviewed Robbie Craig, who is a friend of John Dacey, whom I think you know in Arizona. That's a great episode that unravels the whole private prisons issue. It's specifically we dealt with just like the mass incarceration, but as related to private prisons and just what that entails. It's a crazy issue that I was unaware of. I did a month of research to prepare for that interview, reading this guy, Shane, forget the name of the book now, American Prison was the name of it, and it was just an eye-opener. That's an episode you can listen to. And then there's also Ted, whom was your best friend, my godfather, was episode 7 on the homelessness mental health issue. And that's a heck of an episode to listen to. I don't know if you want to say anything about Ted. I mean, he was your best friend, and you lost him this year.
A tragic situation where he got in a loop. He got sepsis, and doctors didn't attack the sepsis early enough or strong enough when they made their attack, and it kept recurring and getting worse. And when you fail to kill off a sepsis or septic situation, you must hit it with an even larger dose of antibiotics. And when you do that, you risk functions of the body being affected, not just by the sepsis, but also by the antibiotics. And poor Ted went through 6 or 7 different episodes where he was, for God knows what reason, choosing all the wrong doctors and not getting good care. And he perished. I mean, I consider it medical malpractice. He perished because he had a revolving door or a durable cage, and he was just running, trying to catch up, and the thing never, he could never get ahead of it, and it killed him. And you know, our healthcare system is just nuts. I mean, it's the profit motive. It is just killing Americans. I have a book that's called Measure of a Nation. It takes 12 different democratic nations with strong economies, and it compares various systems like the court system, the welfare system, the health system. The U.S. comes out at the bottom in every single one, higher cost, worse mortality or whatever. And I think the public is just, you know, unconscious as to what we could be doing. And the annoying thing is that our political system is set up to not give us statesmen who will use their positions to better our situation on these terrible, wicked problems, whether it's a prison problem or an educational problem or a medical system problem. We do not elect and get and cherish the right kind of leaders. We don't cherish terrible ones, usually, like some countries do, but we're not hitting the apple the way we should.
I mean, in my whatever, I'm not nearly as old as you are, I don't have the experience, but I mean that in a good way, but from my limited study of all this stuff, it seems to always come back to incentives. And then once you can unravel the incentives and understand and align incentives is when you get the change. But until you do that, it's lipstick on a pig or whatever you want to call it. It's you paper over the problem, but if, as long as the incentives remain, the problem, the root is still there and you haven't actually changed it.
So as Sun Tzu said, we live and swim and breathe like a fish in water. We do that in politics. We are surrounded, immersed in, every day we are up to our eyeballs in politics. And those who are making the decisions about how to divert and direct our resources in Washington or in my home state of Arizona, if we don't choose wise people and we don't have a reason to have trust in them, we're not going to get any traction on important social issues. So our system is not very well set up to teach us who are the trusted, good character people. I mean, do you know what it costs to run for the United States Senate today? Oh, geez, it's just an unbelievable amount of money. Where would you get that money? You wouldn't get it from Mom and Pop and Sam and Judy. You would get it from the pharmaceutical industry or whatever. I mean, it's, and, you know, the United this decision about 10 years ago just upended our politics. It allowed corporations to make, United Citizens was the name of that decision, and it upended our politics. It allows corporations to make enormous donations. Talk about incentives. I mean, they have the economic incentive to line their pockets, and now they have the permission to give money to people so as to put the guys in office that will help them. We found a situation in Arizona where the electric utility, which had a monopoly, was subject to the Corporation Commission, and they were spending $4 million each election to make sure that they got the kind of people that they wanted in there to govern the situation and how the electric flowed to the people.
Yeah, outrageous. They call it regulatory capture. We've got two problems in our library of 48, I think now. One of them being lobbyist influence. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, until you cut the umbilical cord there, that is a root cause that underlines everything.
But you can't do that without getting the congressmen and the senators to not need the money that they have to now spend in order to run. To do that, you need a different kind of election procedure.
Well, sure.
Where only very limited publicity and use of the airwaves and so forth will be permitted. It's like if you had for senator in a state, if there were only three debates or three presentations, and that's all you could do, people would prepare for serious debates on the issues. But instead, what they do is they spend $200 million on 16-second ads on the TV.
Well, but I would argue that that's better than nothing to try and equalize in terms of the spending so that you can't have an outsized expenditure for one person that just buys the election, essentially. But I would argue that the real answer there, this is again kind of papering over the problem, you just got to pay them a reasonable, pay them a decent salary, and then make sure that when you take public office, if you're going to be of public service, I think it's just part of the game that all finances are transparent at that point. If you want to hold an office that's a public service, I think you give up the right to privacy. I'm sorry, I don't think you can't trade stocks in that scenario. You can't have private funding transactions, paying into your campaign. I think that's just part of the game.
My mind immediately, because I'm a lawyer, my mind immediately goes to the difference between our court system and that of the civil court, say, in France. In France, if somebody comes out of college and is going to go to law school, he chooses whether he's going to be an advocate or a judge. And from the very first day in French law school, you know whether you're training to be a judge or to be a lawyer. And in the United States, we take lawyers who've been more than 5 years in practice who suddenly have the desire to sit on the bench, and we say, hey, does he look good? Let's make him a judge. well, pardon me, we need to do much the same sort of thing in choosing who it is we're going to have as our congressman or our senator. There needs to be some history. It just blows me away when some guy is running for public office at the age of 50 and he's never done one single thing other than be in business. And all of a sudden he's got $5 million, $10 million and he's going to run for Senate or whatever. This is a person who's shown no interest, no ability, no study and acquisition of knowledge to face the issues, no particular character. And now we are going to choose between him and two or three others. Ah, madness. Madness.
Yeah, but that's why I think all things being equal, choose someone who's self-made in business, and that at least denotes a certain level of competence in terms of being able to make money. All right, well, so let's wind this down. I mean, the message here, I feel like we're kind of sinking into the quagmire of all these, you know, wicked, and by the way, wicked, if you're listening, does not, I mean, although they often are evil problems in the sense that like human trafficking is terrible and it's evil, but that's not what the wicked means in this case. Wicked in this context actually refers to the knotted, intractable overwhelmingness of the problem.
It's a Boston word.
Wicked? Wicked cool?
Sure. Boston word.
Yeah. Well, no, that's not what they mean either. Anyways, what I'm getting at is these things are large. They are overwhelming. It's easy to get down. That's not the message. The whole point the whole reason behind this platform and this podcast and the movement and the events that we do is one of empowerment. It's the idea that people, you know, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. What is the smallest thing that you can do? You have a piece of the puzzle, a skill, something, an experience that you can bring to the table in some small way on one of these problems and focus and coordinate and work with other people and actually do something that matters. And so I guess maybe we end this by, what message, if any, do you have to the people who might, all three of them that might still be listening at this point, what might you say to them who are taking the time to listen to this because they care and they wanted to do something?
So when I was in university, at some point I realized I was in a university named after Louis Dembitz Brandeis, the first Jewish justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. Very wise guy. He was a Boston lawyer, had grown up in Kentucky, and a very thoughtful guy. And he said, a lawyer who draws his very good living from a community in which he lives has an obligation to give a quarter or a third of his time back to that community. And it seems to me that's a good rule to live by. You got to pay for your space on this earth. You got to do some good works to compensate for the fact that you're breathing the air and filling up the space on the street you live on. And if you don't do that, you're not one of the people I want to know. I deal with two kinds of people in my life every day. Those who are other-directed, and those that are totally self-directed, selfish, and out for themselves and no other person. I got no use for the second. I want to live with the first.
All right. I think that's a good place to leave it. We'll include links to all the stuff we talked about. There's been other interviews. I know you've done the KTAR with your friend Mike O'Neill. I'll link to those. All the work you did in the 60s on the civil rights movement. And yeah, it's been good having you on the show, Dad. I'm glad you could make it.
Oh, let's get dinner.
All right.
You've been listening to the Problematic Podcast. To get involved and propose a project idea of your own, or to join in the discussion around one of the projects proposed during the show, visit problematic.app. That's problem, ATTIC.app. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and leave a rating and review on your favorite platform. Until next time, be the change.